Sawbones is a show about medical history, and nothing the hosts say should be taken as medical advice or opinion. It's for fun. Can't you just have fun for an hour and not try to diagnose your mystery boil? We think you've earned it. Just sit back, relax, and enjoy a moment of distraction from that weird growth. You're worth it.
All right. Tongue is about to books. One, two, one, two, three, four.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to Sawbones, Marital Tour of Misguided Medicine. I'm your co-host, Justin McElroy.
And I'm Sydney McElroy.
Sometimes I take a look at the notes you send over, and I kind of think, oh, that's interesting. And I'll have some thoughts about it, like, oh, I should work out some fun jokes about that.
Yeah.
And I don't know what this word means. I don't know what this word means.
You know what this is. Because you have a joke, and I was going to let you get it out of the way early in the
podcast.
Because okay. I already know.
You used the long version, mononucleosis.
Uh-huh. Not just mono.
You know, That's a funny story about mono. I once thought I had mono for an entire month, and turns out I was just really bored.
There we go. There it is. I knew. I wanted to give you space to make that joke, like, right away. Do you think you'll have to make it again? Like,
It's not so much a joke as it is a reenactment of Wayne's World.
Yeah.
A scene in Wayne's World. One of the vignettes from Wayne's World.
It's not ha-ha funny.
Like much of Mr. Meyer's work, it's not ha-ha funny, but in a vacuum, in this specific context, I think it's very, very funny.
Now, about how old were you when you first saw Wayne's World?
12.
Okay. So you say it's not ha-ha funny, but would 12-year-old Justin...
Oh, I was busting up.
Yeah, okay.
No question about it.
12-year-old Justin would disagree.
Yeah.
I wanted to talk about mono, Justin, because I was sick recently.
You had mono?
Well, I don't think
the
I had mono.
The kissing disease?
But I honestly entertained the thought.
Okay.
Because I felt so lousy.
Did it turn out to be mono?
Have you ever actually had mono?
Not to my knowledge.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, I mean,
I thought I had mono.
Okay, stop. I bet you if we tested you for the antibodies, you have.
That's kind of like really judgmental of you.
Well, just statistically, the vast majority of adults have.
Okay.
Because it's contagious, and for a lot of people, you don't have symptoms, so you don't know that you came in contact with the virus.
Okay.
If you're like me, you did know. So I had mono. Here's my mono story.
Okay.
I was on spring break in college, my freshman year of college. This is like a 90s story. I was at the beach, totally MTV spring break. It was not MTV spring break, but I was at the beach for spring break.
Okay.
With my boyfriend at the time.
Oh, my.
And some friends. And towards the end of the week, my throat was so sore. And I kept thinking, maybe this corona will fix it.
Oh, no.
No, it doesn't.
It doesn't fix it.
No, but I had such a sore throat, probably had a fever, but I can tell you none of us had thermometers. And I remember the drive back from the beach because I was just in so much pain, my throat. And then when we got back, I was in tears, told mom and dad, they took me to the urgent care. And I got diagnosed with mono.
Wow.
And it sucked.
No one else will ever suffer this way. I want to become a doctor. And I'll
cure mono.
Cure mono. And this will never happen to anyone ever again.
That wasn't it, but it's not. And I was tired. A lot of people, when they get mono, get tired for quite a while. Mm-hmm. It was a rough few weeks of college.
It sounds rough.
Yeah. But anyway, recently I had a sore throat again. I think we talked about it on the show, and some swollen lymph nodes and a fever. And then Riley did.
Yes, I do remember that.
Yeah, and I started thinking, like, gosh, it feels like it dragged on so long. Because when Riley told me, I was like, oh, I wonder if you have mono. You've been kissing somebody? Because
you're a doctor.
I'm also her older sister, though, right, so I'm supposed to say that. Like, ha-ha, were you kissing somebody? Yeah. That's what I'm, like, legally supposed to say.
Right.
But then I thought, like, well, heck, did I have mono again? Like, it's not likely, but did mono reactivate? Did I come in contact with it? Like, mm-hmm. did I get mono again? So I couldn't believe we've never talked about the kissing disease, as it is I hate that word.
Colloquially.
It's a tough word to say. Mono is caused by a herpes virus called the Epstein-Barr virus, usually EBV is how it's, you know, shortened. Mm-hmm. It's largely spread through saliva. So there you go, the kissing thing. It has an incubation period of 4 to 8 weeks, so it can be hard sometimes to know exactly, well, depending on how much kissing you're doing.
Hey.
When you were exposed. And you can stay infectious for quite a while, like months.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm. Which is why I already said the vast majority of adults have had it, whether you know it or not. If you're a grown-up, and whether you feel like it or not, if you're legally a grown-up, you probably have the antibodies to mono in your body. Like, we could find EBV antibodies in there. I read old journal articles about mono, mm-hmm. and when they talk about the mode of transmission, like back in the 50s, it's really fun.
It was illegal to say kissing in the 50s, right?
Well, no.
You couldn't print that. It was illegal.
And maybe, you know what? This doesn't change, because like some of the journal articles from more recent years are similarly like, it's like a very buttoned up science-y way of talking about making out. And they're like, it was like one article from the 50s said it is only spread by deep kissing.
Ew.
That's in a journal article.
That's a worse way of saying
it. A scientist wrote that. Deep kissing. The episode of deep kissing. There's one from 2015 where they call it intimate oral contact among teenagers and young adults.
Bad.
Intimate oral contact.
Also bad.
There's another one, intimate oral contact of such a nature as to permit direct transfer of saliva.
Oh, no.
These are, like, people just wrote, like, they just say kissing.
Just say kissing.
Or Frenching.
Frenching? No.
Or I believe our British friends would say snogging.
Snogging?
Now, I've always wondered that about snogging. Is snogging just like you kissed, or is that like,
I think it's like making out.
It's a make-out sesh.
I think making out is snogging.
Yeah. Okay.
This is my understanding.
I don't know. You know what?
Do not email us.
No, you can email us.
Email Sydney.
We got so many emails about asafoetida.
Yeah.
Yeah. Should I mention that? By the way, thank you for the recipes. Thank you for sharing your experiences. I loved reading all those emails. And also, we did get some.
Yeah, we got some. So we'll try it
and
soon.
We can already attest to the fact that you do not have to warm it up to smell it.
Yeah, it's right there.
It's right there.
For you to enjoy.
As soon as we opened it.
Yep.
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 I think it smells a little like wild onions.
It would be like if a human onion had BO. That, like, it's a pungent.
A human onion?
Like, if an onion was a human that had BO.
Like onion from the
it's
cartoon?
It's like onion, like intensity onion. It's like, what's up? I'm onion. It's attacking you.
It is. It reminded me specifically, though, of, like, wild onions that grow out in the yard that we pull up. I always used to find those and pull those and smell them, and I like that. Except that to a degree where it's like, no, too much, too much, too much.
I didn't hate it. It's, like, kind of powerful. It's, like, impactful. I felt something.
Yeah.
Know?
We have not cooked yet.
That's all it takes.
But I'm excited to try it. Anyway, it was thought that for a while that sex may increase the risk of transmission. Mm-hmm. But then they did a study that showed, here was their conclusion. Deep kissing, with or without coitus, had the same risk of primary EBV infection throughout their undergraduate years.
Deep kissing, I still can't quite
deep
get
kissing, past. With or without coitus.
That's what it says I'm looking for on my Tinder profile. I'm after deep kissing, with or without coitus.
There's also things like they spend a lot of time trying to figure out, like, because they wanted to figure out this, there is this long incubation period, right? Mm-hmm. So part of when you're studying a virus or studying an illness and you're trying to figure out, like, how long is it between when you get it and when you show symptoms, that helps us figure out how it's transmitted and who gave it to who and whatnot.
And the R-naught.
You have to ask questions to figure out the time from kissing episode to onset of symptoms, or time from an incident of intimate kissing.
Deep kissing.
Did you have an incident of intimate kissing recently? These would have been the surveys. Can you imagine? You're on your college campus. You're like walking from your dorm to class. It's early. Maybe you're a little hungover. You're like rushing so that you're not late for, you know, whatever.
Someone flags calculus. You down.
And like some guy with a clipboard stops you and is like, excuse me, when would you say was your last incident of intimate kissing?
Ooh, let me think.
It's a tough one.
And you're like, I'm not going to answer these questions. And then they're like, we'll give you a free t-shirt.
Ooh.
And you're like, oh, hey.
And by the way, the t-shirt says deep kissing on it. What do you think?
Now, for those that do develop symptoms, there's a range, as I said. It can range from fatigue, swollen lymph nodes, fever, sore throat for a couple of weeks to months. It can go on for months that you feel really exhausted, really fatigued. Not just like the normal, you know, if you have a viral syndrome, if you get the flu or something like it, you know, you're tired. You sleep more. If you had COVID, you probably slept more. But it can go on for a lot longer, intense fatigue, intense body aches. One other thing that we specifically watch when patients have mono is that your spleen can get enlarged.
Mm.
And that doesn't, you probably wouldn't notice that. So it's not like that's causing you a problem inherently, but what it can lead to is that if you then are like involved in a contact sport or some sort of accident, or I don't know, you get in a fight, your spleen can rupture.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a big deal because if your spleen starts bleeding and it doesn't stop, well, generally any bleeding that doesn't stop
in the body from organs and stuff is all bad stuff.
Is a bad thing. So, and generally it's going to resolve on its own. Mm-hmm. Like the spleen is going to go back to its normal size all by itself. But for a while, you have to limit things like that. So because of the age group that can get this, teenagers and young adults, this is relevant because like, as an almost 40-year-old, I don't engage in a lot of contact sports regularly.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not a professional athlete, so
right.
Why would I? But for younger people who are playing contact sports, who are in high school sports or college sports or, you know, that kind of thing, this could be a much bigger deal. Even really heavy lifting can be discouraged, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So that is something that I remember them telling me that, like, don't play any contact sports.
Okay.
I was like, I'm a biology major.
So I am good on that front.
I'm fine.
Self-selected for not getting head injuries.
They'd ask me in high school, I'm in show choir. Does that count?
Yeah.
No, that's not true. I played soccer. Soccer, that would have been bad.
Yeah.
There are rare serious complications. That is true for a lot of viruses like this. But for most people who have had it, you were like really tired and you were achy for a while and you couldn't play a sport. I told Riley when I thought it was possible she had it, like, she was like, well, do I need to know? And I said, well, honestly, right now there's not a huge value in you knowing one way or another, you know, but, don't engage in contact sports and try not to get punched or kicked in the stomach.
Yeah.
And she said, Sydney, I live my entire life trying not to get punched or kicked in the stomach. And I said, that's fair. The first description of mono going way, way back was written in 1887. That's how long we knew about the syndrome, not the virus yet. We didn't know about what caused it, but we knew there was something that we would eventually call mono. It was written by a Russian doctor who's also known as like the founder of Russian pediatrics, Neil Filatov. And he wrote about the condition after observing it in patients, and it was called Filatov's disease for a while before it was called mono. He didn't call it that.
Yeah, maybe he doesn't want a disease.
Other people called it. He called it idiopathic adenitis.
Should have known that wasn't going to catch on. Yeah.
Big lymph nodes, don't know why. That's how I would interpret idiopathic adenitis. Big lymph nodes, don't know why.
Okay.
That's what that means.
Okay, I got it.
I was translating.
No, it's not a different language, right?
Medicine?
I guess so. Yeah.
Medicine is a different language. And enough. That's part of what I do is I translate.
Big lymph nodes, don't know why.
Yeah, that's what idiopathic means, we don't know why. Yet. That was just me saying yet.
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm hopeful. Other people named it after him. I don't know why I'm defending him. Maybe he was arrogant. I don't know if he was arrogant or not. But like, as far as I know, he just called it that. And then other people were like, Filatov's disease. But that didn't stick.
I think that's a mixed bag, man. I don't know. I wouldn't want it. I don't need that to be my legacy. Everybody's like, ugh, I got Filatov's again. Ugh, hate this. Hate that guy, whoever that guy is. I know he's long dead, but I have bad feelings towards him. That sucks.
I would love for something to be named after me. I don't really care what it is or why or, you know, I mean, Well, the why is probably, hopefully I had something to do with it in a positive way. Now, I don't want something named after me if it's like, I don't know, I accidentally created it or something.
Well, you don't want to fall. I don't, again, like you, there's a disease, like Lou Gehrig's, if you're
because
just a
you
fame, if you're just a fame, that's not great.
Well, obviously that is not what one would desire. Yes.
Yes. Like you don't want to be like such a notable occurrence of this that it is named after you either. I don't think anybody wants that.
I am talking from a scientific, like from the medical community perspective.
Unless it's like McElroy's huge muscleitis, like if you have some sort of strength-based illness that makes you too strong.
I don't think there's any chance of a huge muscleitis ever being called McElroy's huge muscleitis.
But it's a disease. I get it.
Like it's from any of us.
But it's pathogenic. That would be the whole point, is that it's pathogenic. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? So you get it. It's a disease you get. It's not because you naturally have huge muscles. You catch McElroy's huge muscleitis, and then you do have huge muscles, and it's contagious.
I love that you think that if I name something after myself or if I get something named after me, it's going to be McElroy something.
That was me. I was naming
it's
it
gonna
after
It's going to be Sydney.
Sydney,
if
your
it's
first
named
name?
McElroy something, they're gonna think it has something to do with you, so it's gonna have to be named Sydney.
Bad news,
nobody knows my maiden name.
Well, guys, the research is done. I finally discovered it. Hepatitis Doug. It's my own new brand.
There's at the university we both went to at Marshall, a lot of the buildings are named after people. The science building is just named the science building.
Yeah.
And that's been a goal of mine. Is that that's going to be the Sydney building.
So a goal of yours is to donate tens of millions of dollars to a university, right? Because like,
what if I just do something so great that they name it after me? I don't want to give them that much money. I just want them to name it the Sydney building.
Well, yeah, that's how it works. You do something so great that people give you tens of millions of dollars and then you give that to the university. That's how they honor you.
Sydney building coming soon.
Sydney building?
Yeah.
Okay.
Sydney building. I like my first name. We have to get to the point that it is infectious mononucleosis caused by the Epstein-Barr virus. We're about to get there, but first we got to go to the billing department.
Let's go. The medicines that escalate macabre for the mouth. I have really enjoyed experimenting with fashion. Thanks to Quince. Now, I know that sounds wild coming from me, Justin McElroy, a podcaster. Why, Justin, are you even wearing clothes? I hear you. But when I want to try a new look, what I love about Quince is they have a lot of different clothing items that are at a great price and are really well made. So if you want to try something, you're not sure if it's like, is this going to be the right fit for me? I don't know. Try it out with Quince. There's craftsmanship that you see in every detail of these clothes. I've bought several, like a pair of shorts I love, a pair of pants I wear literally every day. I mean, nearly every day, not literally every day. You know what I mean? Because there's some days you're just like, you can't. But I've been so happy with the pieces that we have gotten from Quince. And also there's a really wide variety of stuff. You know, there's silk tops, skirts for dressing up, denim for everyday wear. I don't mention a lot of the specific items because honestly, you shouldn't trust me about that part of it if it's outside my specific range of clothes for my body. But I will say this, for my body, Quince does right. It sounds weird now that I say it like that. Find gifts so good you'll want to keep them with Quince. Go to quince.com/sawbones for free shipping on your order. 365-day returns. Now available in Canada, too. That's quince.com/sawbones to get free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/sawbones.
So there's a lot of stuff that medical TV shows can get wrong, but I know one of the most disappointing things for me when I started practicing is how uncomfortable conventional scrubs can be. They don't necessarily fit all body shapes really well, and they're scratchy. And that's until I found Figs. So our shifts in the hospital can be really long, or in the office, and you need scrubs that feel good, that fit you well, and they're going to last all day long. Figs make scrubs for the medical professionals of today. They're not like a paper bag. They're not itchy. They feel great. They're so soft and comfortable. They're form-fitting. They're made for the kind of work that we actually do, where we're up and down, we're on our feet. Sometimes I'm sitting on the exam room floor checking out somebody's toenails, and I need to be comfortable while I'm doing it.
They're antimicrobial, so you know that you're going to be protected. You can wash them every time you wear them, which is super important. I wash my scrubs, obviously, every day that I wear them. And they look good. So you can look like those cute TV docs and nurses that that made us go into medicine in the first place. You can check out tops like the Katarina and the Cade Pants. It's an easy, relaxed fit. And then so many cargo pockets, which I can tell you that's the main thing we need, are pockets for our pens, pockets for our notebooks, pockets for my Narcan, pockets for everything. I love Figs. They are so comfortable. And with the work that I do, kind of unconventional out in the street medicine, I need something that feels good all day long. With back to school season upon us, it's the perfect time to stock up with some fresh outfits for the year. And Figs just dropped a brand new collection of limited edition styles and accessories. If you're in healthcare or if you're shopping for someone who is, you can get 15% off your first order at wearfigs.com with the code FIGSRX. That's wearfigs.com, code FIGSRX, FIGSRX.
Dear Reading Glasses, it's been years since I've been able to read. I missed it so much, but I had no idea where to start. I felt so overwhelmed. But thanks to your show, now I'm back to enjoying books again and feeling like a reader. Love, Sarah.
Yeah, that's an email we actually answered. Okay, maybe not that email specifically, but one just like it, because most of our listeners are named Sarah.
We're Reading Glasses, and we're here to solve all your reader problems. We give advice, help you find books you love, and discuss reading without making you feel pressured.
No matter what you read or how you read it, we'll help you do it better. Reading Glasses, every week on Maximum Fun.
Are elephants right-handed?
What's the middlest size in the universe?
What is the history of fan fiction?
Let's find out together on our show, Let's Learn Everything, where we learn anything and everything interesting.
My name's Caroline, and I studied biodiversity and conservation.
My name's Tom, and I studied computer science and cognitive blah, 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 blah.
Did you?
And my name's Ella, and I studied stem cells and regenerative medicine.
On our show, we do as much research as you would for a class, but we don't get in trouble for making each other laugh.
And we get to say f***.
Maybe not in the trailer.
Subscribe to Let's Learn Everything every other Thursday on Maximum Fun.
Okay, I'm ready for this to transform.
So at this point, it's 1920. Filatov's disease is the syndrome that is called mono. There were two other researchers in 1920 that observed this infectious disease that caused fever and these big lymph nodes and a big, really bad sore throat. And specifically that looking on a blood film, so looking at a smear of your blood under a microscope. Sometimes we do that, right? Like a lot of things, labs are automated. They just put some blood in a machine and it counts the cells and counts different components of the blood and gives us a list of numbers, right? Sometimes we actually need a pathologist to look at the slide, smear some blood on the slide in a certain way with certain stains and then look at it and tell us what's in there. Back then, of course, that's what you would have done. You weren't using machines. So anyway, so they looked and they noticed that there were atypical lymphocytes. Lymphocytes are a certain part of your white blood cells, a certain type of white blood cells. And they were large and the nucleus of them looked different. And so they called them atypical. Mm-hmm. So they saw a lot of these. And these kinds of lymphocytes resembled another kind of white blood cell called a monocyte. So as a result, mononucleosis.
Got it.
Yes.
What an origin story.
Is where the name.
I was on the edge of my seat for that one.
Mono comes from. So the two researchers, Sprunt and Evans, renamed it mononucleosis in 1920 because it's the same syndrome, but specifically if you look on a blood film, you see that. And this could be a diagnostic criteria, right? Because a lot of things can cause fever, a sore throat, some lymph nodes. Like a lot of things could cause these other symptoms. But then also if you look on a blood film and see this, now you have a diagnosis.
I am glad they went with mononucleosis, though, because can you imagine if somebody's like, don't kiss me, I've got Sprunt's.
Sprunt's would be a rough one.
I got Sprunt's. Don't kiss, keep your distance. I'm just riddled with Sprunt's.
That is, Sprunt's is rough.
Sprunt's is rough. I got rough. The Sprunt's. Something fierce.
The virus.
Changing
the
shirts four times a day. These Sprunt's are so bad.
Horse Brunt. Don't do this to Horse Brunt.
It's not Sprunt's fault.
I mean, I can't. My maiden name is Smurl, and I don't know that it's yards better than Sprunt. So we're in the same boat, buddy. Epstein-Barr virus was discovered. One of the researchers was Epstein, as you can imagine, in 1964.
Can I guess the other one?
Using electron microscopy. So now we had the technology at this point to look more closely, right? Like that's what a lot of, when we talk about sort of understanding microorganisms and infectious disease and contagions and everything, as our ability to look at things that are smaller advanced.
We need better microscopes, we can see better.
Yeah, we can see smaller things. And so now first, you know, that's great. We can see that the cells are different. Well, those are larger, so you don't have to have an electron microscope to look at, you know, white blood cells.
Mm-hmm.
But you do when you're looking at viruses. So we get to a point in 1964 where we can use an electron microscope and we can look at specifically in a kind of cancer. Burkitt's lymphoma is a specific kind of cancer. And they found this virus in these cancer cells. And it's interesting because the story, and this is not tied to mono yet. They haven't yet attached it to mono. They're just discovering the virus that we would also understand causes mono. Epstein found this, but he, like a good scientist, thought that somebody else should repeat it. Okay. Because then that's good. It needs it's to good. Be,
yes.
You know, it has to be something that gotta you can be
repeatable.
Repeat. Yeah. So he had reached out to other British virologists to look at it, and nobody wanted to work with him. They were like, nah, we're just not interested in this. This is not something that, I don't know, we want to spend time on. Maybe they had, like, disputes. I don't know what the issues were. So he was having trouble finding somebody to repeat these findings so that he could see if they were valid.
Mm-hmm.
So he sent some of the cells to Klaus Hummler in Philadelphia, who they had just had like a sabbatical together. Mm-hmm. So they were like buds. And he was like, hey, will you look at these cells and see if you can also find this virus in these cells? And then we can say, like, we both did independently and it's, you know, we know that this virus is connected to this type of cancer. Now, the problem is Hummler, and I don't know if this was because he was just on this sabbatical, but he had lost all of his funds. And so his laboratory had been completely dismantled. So he didn't have anything to look at it with. He was like, this is really cool, and I'm very good at this. I don't have a microscope, though, and nobody's that good.
To see without a microscope.
Yeah, nobody's that good. You can't see a virus without a microscope. So he took the cells to a different laboratory in Philadelphia, Henley's laboratory. And he was like, hey, would it be cool with you if we, like, had a little collabo? And you looked at these cells.
One thing you bring to this, what I bring to it is that I'm very good at science and everything. What you bring to it is very cool. You have a microscope. It's like the one friend who had his own car in high school, right? So you got to hang out with that guy. Got to hang out with Dylan. He's got his own car.
Well, but Henley brought more to the table because also a scientist.
Two microscopes?
Well, wow. Also a scientist, also could find it. It's interesting because, you know, and we've talked about a lot of different scientific discoveries where a lot of people are finding the sort of the same thing at the same time. And there's always an inherent competition between all of these people, usually dudes, not always dudes, but a lot of dudes. There's usually an inherent competition because if you're the one that finds it, you get your name on it.
Yeah.
Epstein. And so it to go to someone else's lab and be like, I am on the verge of a monumental discovery and I need your lab equipment because I don't have any, is a big deal, you know? It shouldn't be, right? All of science should be collaborative, but it's not. And part of that is because you can make money off stuff, but that's not really in this case. Part of it is just because people want a legacy. They want to be famous. They want to be known for the virus they saw.
Yeah.
So they characterized this new, it was in the herpes virus category, and they find this new virus, the Epstein-Barr virus at this point. So they know, by the way, and that's another thing about this, this is really focused on mono, the illness, but Epstein-Barr virus can also cause this lymphoma, this specific kind of cancer. So it is a virus that can do different things. Now, what's really interesting is that there was a technologist who was working in Henley's laboratory. So this is kind of like serendipity, right? Like Epstein couldn't find anybody to confirm these findings in England. He had to send them all the way to Philadelphia to a guy whose lab was dismantled, who had to then take it to another guy's lab and ask, can you help me? And there's a tech working in that lab who regularly, they started doing these experiments with Epstein-Barr virus, and who didn't have any antibodies. They looked in a lot of people's blood to see, do they have antibodies against this new virus we found? And as I said, a lot of people had them, right? Because they're adults, and a lot of adults had been exposed. Well, this tech was unique in that they did not have any antibodies against Epstein-Barr virus, right? So that they could donate some lymphocytes to do experiments with, which is something we don't really do much in labs today. Like, ask our lab techs also, can we take blood from you and use your blood cells in the experiments that we're doing and that you're helping us with? We don't do that as often these days. But back then, that would have been more, I guess, more standard. But it was interesting because, so one, she could donate that she didn't have these antibodies, they knew. And two, the cells would only grow for so long in culture, and then they would die. They didn't continue to grow forever, which is not strange. However, in August of 1967, she missed work because she was sick. So she ended up missing 5 days of work. Initially, her doctor thought she had rubella, which is sometimes called German measles, and we've done a show on that
before. Yeah, yeah.
But he also considered, you know, there's this thing called mono.
Whoa.
And you might have that thing called mono. So they checked her for rubella antibodies. Okay. She didn't have them.
Good.
And so then they checked her for a different kind of antibody. There's a specific antibody called a heterophile antibody, which the important thing to know about it is that it's closely related to infection with mono. It's the thing that they were looking for, like if you had a mono test. They're looking for this specific kind of antibody to see, is it possible you've had mono? So, and the laboratory that she was helping work in is what established this as the test. So anyway.
Wow.
So they do the test, and it's positive. She has the antibody now.
Great. No one kissed.
And
no
also, when they took some of her lymphocytes and tried to grow them in culture, they just kept growing continuously, which was interesting. And they were positive for Epstein-Barr virus antigens. Mm. So here now we have somebody who has the syndrome of mono, who we know for a fact didn't have this antibody before because we have, because she was donating cells, and now moving forward does have this antibody.
Wow.
It's just a very lucky coincidental thing that sort of proved like mono is caused by this virus that we have this antibody against, and there's the antibody that you can test for, and there's the antigens that prove the virus is there, and there's the syndrome of the fever and the sore throat and all the stuff, you know?
Yeah.
So this was a huge break. Yeah, it's a huge lucky break that shows that Epstein-Barr virus was responsible for this, you know, very common infection called mononucleosis. They did other, obviously they wanted to replicate that as well.
Can you help me understand something very quickly? The distinction between a virus and an infection. So, like, how has Epstein-Barr virus caused mononucleosis? Like, what's the difference?
Well, so you've got to think about the fact that you can get exposed to a virus. So, like, the virus gets into your system, right? However, through saliva or blood or whatever it is. And your body mounts a response, right? Like, we've talked about how the immune system works. Something's going to detect an invader and take it and try to check it out and see what it is and see, like, do we already have attack? Do we have antibodies against this already? Do we have a way to attack this? Whatever. And your body is going to mount an immune response to remove that invader. Sometimes that happens so quickly that you get exposed to something. You create these antibodies against it, right? Mm-hmm. But you never actually get sick versus it establishing an infection where you get symptoms, you become ill. You're probably contagious. Mm-hmm. And then the symptoms usually have a name, like the viral syndrome, the disease, the illness that is caused by the virus. Think about right now, COVID-19 is the disease, the illness, the sickness that is caused by a novel coronavirus. The virus itself is different from the disease COVID-19.
Okay, that makes sense. Yes.
And so the reason that's really important, especially looking back from a historical perspective, we had to have pretty regimented ways of saying conclusively, okay, well, I examined you and did studies on you and can diagnose you with this disease process, but what is causing it? It was harder, right? Because we couldn't look at viruses. Once we had the ability to find viruses, then I needed a really regimented way to say, okay, you have this. Let's figure out what it's caused by looking in your blood, seeing what we can find, and comparing it to other people who have the same syndrome and what's in their blood. Hmm. And then we can conclusively say that constellation of symptoms, that collection of illness, is caused by this.
Okay. That makes sense.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay. So that's what they had to do next, right? Because they found it in this one lab tech, but that doesn't mean it's conclusive. You know, it could be a coincidence. We've talked about the guy who thought syphilis and gonorrhea were the same thing.
Because people come at the same time a lot.
Yes, and because he accidentally infected himself with both. That's it. Medical science back like 100 years. Anyway. So they had a bunch of serum from 6 students already at this lab. So they had a lot of pre- and post-illness samples.
Mm-hmm.
And so they started looking for the virus, for the antibodies, putting it together with, like, descriptions of the symptoms that the students have. And at the end, they were like, we figured it out.
Done.
Epstein-Barr virus causes infectious mononucleosis. And you can do a heterophile antibody test, look for this antibody, and that tells us that you have it.
Boom.
And that is how we pieced it all together back in the 60s. We still use antibody testing, specific serology, to look for patterns to tell you. It's not as simple as one test per se. If you ever get a test for mono, they're going to usually do this Epstein-Barr virus panel of antibodies.
Mm-hmm.
And it's several things we're looking at to see, do you have it now or did you have it in the past?
Okay.
And that pattern of antibodies helps us know, like, is this, because so many people have been exposed to it that just testing you to see, do you have the antibody? Well, I mean,
doesn't
I do.
Tell you very much, right?
Yeah, you probably do. So we need a certain pattern to tell us, are you acutely ill with it, or did you just have it and you got something else now? The treatment for it is pretty much supportive. It's a viral syndrome. It'll go away on its own.
You just got to get you through it. Stay away from kissing.
Yeah, you are contagious. So, yes, stay away from kissing or anything that would share saliva. So, like, you know, I don't know, food and drink, depending on what you're doing, I guess.
What do you mean? What
it's like
you're
full
doing?
Of backwash.
Ew, gross.
I don't know.
That's
the worst
we've phrase.
Talked about, like, deep kissing and intimate oral contact.
Yeah,
so.
There's a lot of unpleasant sounds in this episode. Are we almost done?
It's a virus. It'll run its course. Fluids, rest, avoid anything that's going to rupture your spleen.
Again, good rule for life.
And then, of course, treatment for the sore throat, because a sore throat can be, I will say, having had it when I was younger, it was really bad. I mean, I could still swallow, but it hurt. I could only hold down liquids. It's rough. So treatment for that. One interesting thing is that because the sore throat is such a big feature, it is often misdiagnosed as
strep.
Strep, yes.
Ah, yes.
And if people don't, which we often won't, do like a test for strep. We'll just look at you and based on a set of clinical criteria say, yeah, we think you have strep throat. Here's some amoxicillin. If you do that, there's a characteristic rash that you'll get if you accidentally mistreat mono with amoxicillin.
Your delight at that fact was adorable.
Well, I think it's if you are in medical school, you will probably get asked this question at some point. You will have a patient that you will think has strep throat in the question. In the question, they will say you treated them with amoxicillin. And then they came back a few days later and they're covered in a red spotty rash. And they said, I think I'm allergic to the amoxicillin. And what you're supposed to know,
it was
probably mono all along.
I screwed.
Or maybe you're allergic
I
to amoxicillin.
I screwed up.
But
I'm a doofus. I'm a bad doctor. I missed it.
Well. No, it's just
I was so careful, Sydney. How could this happen?
So anyway, that's mono. I don't know. You're supposed to, so most people only ever get it once in their life, but the virus, I mean, it can live with you forever in your B lymphocytes. And so it is possible for it to reactivate. It is possible to come in contact and get like some mild symptoms again. All these things are possible.
Anything's possible.
It's not the most common. So I don't know. I do wonder. I still have a sore throat.
Who knows?
It's been over a month. And then I just, for completeness, there are a lot of other things associated with Epstein-Barr virus, as I mentioned, including things like chronic fatigue syndrome, which you kind of get into when you start talking about mono reactivating and stuff like that. But that's a whole other issue and that's much, it would take us a whole other episode to cover all that.
And we don't have a whole other episode because this is the end of this one. Thanks so much for listening. Thanks to the taxpayers for the use of their song Medicines as the intro and outro of our program. Thanks to Max Fun for having us as part of their extended podcasting family. And thanks to you for listening. We really appreciate it. That's going to do it for us for this week. Until next time, my name is Justin McElroy.
I'm Sydney McElroy.
And as always, don't drill a hole in your head.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.